Jesus of Nazareth, born around 4 to 3 BC, he is the Christ. He is the Messiah. He is God in the flesh and the one who was sent to reconcile God and man, to reconcile sinful creation with a holy Creator. This is an important belief that we have. It's not something that we hold ignorantly. It's not a belief that we have that is blind. It's not something that we necessarily are arrogant about, that, oh, well, we know something that other people don't. Hopefully we would be the first to admit that there are things in the Bible that are difficult to understand. If you read closely in 2 Peter chapter 3, 14 through 18, Peter is writing and he's talking and he says, you know, Paul also writes to us about these things. Some of the things that Paul writes are difficult to understand. He admits Paul writes about things that are difficult to understand. But the cornerstone of our preaching is that Jesus Christ is the Messiah. And that is plainly seen. It is simply set forth in this book that we have. He is the Messiah. He is God in the flesh. He is a Messiah because, as the Gospel of Mark shows us, which I'll be preaching from for the next few times that I preach. But Mark shows this Jesus, who is the Messiah, who is the Christ, to be a man of authority, a man of power, and a man of action. It is the life of Jesus that moves us to place him on the throne of our hearts. We believe this because we believe the testimony that Christ came with authority and with power. He was a man of action with a clear mission. Let's notice, turn with me to the book of Mark. You should already be there, but let's go over to the first chapter. The power in the Gospels is not so much in the persuasiveness or the beauty of the language, though the language of each of the authors of the Gospels and letters is unique, and it comes out according to their personality in many ways. But the power is not in the men who tell the story. It's in the life that the story is about. The life of Jesus is what moves us to place him on the throne of our hearts. Notice the impact of Jesus on all of these different people he has. Mark crams into the first two chapters this amazing story of Jesus interacting with all of these different people. Starting in verse 16. As Jesus was going along by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net in the sea, for they were fishermen. Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." These are hard fishermen, perhaps like big rig truckers of today, right? Hard-working men, but they're hard men. They're isolated men, and they've never been called for any greater purpose than what they do day to day, and yet Jesus calls them to work with him. Come down with me to verse 23 and through 26. They're in the synagogue now. Jesus is teaching. Just then there was a man in their synagogue with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, saying, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be quiet and come out of him." Here is this man whose life has been insane. He was possessed by a demon. I don't deny the fact that there was an evil spirit inside, but it caused him, he never had a sane thought until he met Jesus. Jesus gave this man his sanity back. Verse 30, Jesus goes now to a woman, perhaps with a simple illness, a fever. His friend's mother-in-law, right? What obligation does a friend have to his friend's mother-in-law, right? Verse 30. Now Simon's mother-in-law was lying sick with a fever, and immediately they spoke to Jesus about her. And he came up to her and raised her up, taking her by the hand, and the fever left her, and she waited on them. Jesus has called the hard fisherman, and he's given sanity to an insane, demon-possessed man, and now he gives hope to this previously hopeless, sick woman. Verse 35, we continue in the story. In the early morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went away to a secluded place and was praying there. Simon and his companions searched for him. They found him and said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus said to them, "Let us go somewhere else to the towns nearby so that I may preach there also, for that is what I came for." The disciples had never seen a man pray like this. They had never seen someone, a rabbi whose task is to bring in students, and yet he goes away to be alone from everyone to pray. They had never seen anything like this. Verse 40. This may be one of the most significant things Jesus does early. He says, "And a leper came to Jesus, beseeching him and falling on his knees before him, saying, 'If you are willing, you can make me clean.'" Now here's where this action of Jesus becomes very significant. Moved with compassion, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I am willing, be cleansed." Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. We know that Jesus can heal. We've already seen him heal this woman with a word. And yet he touches a man who had never been touched in his life because of his disease, because of the stigma, because of the command that had been placed on him. Continue into chapter 2, verse 13. "He went out again by the seashore, and all the people were coming to him, and he was teaching them. As he passed by, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, 'Follow me.' And he got up and followed him." What are we, May 15th? Are your taxes done? Right? You got your taxes all finished? Do you include a tax man in the greatest work that you're going to go do? Let's go save some souls. All right, let me go get my accountant. Right? Does that make any sense? And yet Jesus includes a man who had never been included in anything else. Think about Levi's situation. Levi was a Jew, and yet he was collecting taxes for the Romans. A despised individual, and yet Jesus includes this man. He suffers the insufferable. Go on down to verse 15. "And it happened that while he was reclining at the table in his house, and many tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many of them, and they were following him. When the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, 'Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors?'" You know, Pharisees had never been rebuked before. And yet, Jesus says in verse 17, "Hearing this, Jesus said, 'It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call righteous, but sinners.'" The arrogant Pharisees who had never been rebuked are suddenly being rebuked by this mysterious man from Nazareth. And we'll finish our tour of these first few chapters with the verse we just read. Not only does he rebuke those who have never been rebuked before, but Jesus reveals himself as holy to people who had never seen what holiness was. Jesus called those who had never been called. He gave sanity to those who were insane. He gave hope to the hopeless. He prayed like no one had ever prayed before. He touched those who were untouched. He forgave those who could not find forgiveness. He included those who had never been included. He rebuked those who had never been rebuked. And he showed himself as holy to people who had never seen anything that is holy. This guy is worth investigating, Mark says. Look at this guy. Look at the number of different people that he has impacted in a way that they have never seen before. It is the life of Jesus that moves us to place him on the throne of our hearts, because Jesus is like nothing that we have ever seen before. You know, we acknowledge the need for an authority in so many areas of our life, don't we? I mean, think about the government, right? Or a nation. A nation needs an authority. A nation needs some type of constitution. They need some type of leader, of some type of president to have authority and to lead them. We don't deny the importance of a good leader in our nation. How about in our business, right? I mean, maybe you don't like to admit that you like your boss. Maybe you don't have a very good boss, but doesn't that make the difference if you have an authority and a good boss in whatever line of business that you're in? How about in our families? How much influence does the head of the house have on the family? Don't we need an authority in our families, in the home? Don't we need someone to lead the family, to make decisions, to make sure that everyone is being attended to and that their needs are there? In so many areas of our life, we admit to a need for an authority, for someone to sit on the throne of the nation and of our business and in our family. But what about in our personal life? Should it be any different? Let's go back to Daniel chapter 9. Come back with me, perhaps somewhere close to 600 years before Christ. Israel was supposed to have God on their throne. God was supposed to be their king, and yet they said, no, we want a king like everybody else. We want to put someone else on our throne. Really, what they said was, God, we want to sit on our own throne. We want to be in charge of everything that we do. Didn't last very long. Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon and then Cyrus of the Persians actually sat on the throne of Israel, the thrones of the world. And here we find God's people in captivity. They've been captured, like I said, by Babylon and by the Persians. And Daniel pleads for God. He says, God, we need someone to come in and we need someone to save us. Let's start in verse 16 of Daniel chapter 9. O Lord, in accordance with all of your righteous acts, let now your anger and your wrath turn away from your city Jerusalem, your holy mountain. For because of our sins and the iniquities of our fathers, Jerusalem and your people have become a reproach to all those around us. So now, our God, listen to the prayer of your servant and to his supplications. And for your sake, O Lord, let your face shine on your desolate sanctuary. O my God, incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes and see our desolations and the city which is called by your name. For we are not presenting our supplications before you on account of any merits of our own, but on account of your great compassion. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, listen and take action. For your own sake, O my God, do not delay. Because your city and your people are calling you by name. He says, we've tried letting ourselves and letting someone else sit on the throne of our hearts. And God, we need you to come back and to rescue us. Not because of anything we've done that is great, but because of your great compassion. Verse 20. Now, verse 20 through 27, if you read much commentaries and other things, a lot of the commentators will tell you that there's really not a disputed phrase in verses 20 through 27. This is a complicated passage when you get down to slicing the words apart and trying to see exactly what is being referred to here. But if you step back and if you see the big picture of Daniel chapter 9, God sends an answer to Daniel that can be clearly understood. God sends an answer by way of the man, the angel Gabriel, to Daniel. And he says, I'm going to answer your call for me to save you, but the answer is not really going to come right now, or even next week, or even in 5 years, or even in a decade, or even in a century. He says, I'm going to send someone called Messiah, the prince, and he's going to have the authority and the power and the action to rule in your life. Start with me in verse 20. Now while I was speaking and praying, this is Daniel speaking, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, presenting my supplication before the Lord my God in behalf of the holy mountain of my God, while I was still speaking in prayer, then the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision previously, came to me in my extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering. He gave me instruction and he talked with me and said, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you insight with understanding. At the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued, and I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. So give heed to the message and gain understanding of the vision. Notice carefully in verse 24 and verse 25 all of the things that are supposed to happen when this Messiah comes. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people, for your holy city, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. I want to stop here because the details of this passage is not what I want to get into. The important thing I want to emphasize is that God's people, God's nation, needed someone with authority and with power and with action to come and to save them. And this is what Gabriel says is coming. When this man comes, he will be like nothing you have ever seen before. He will do things that no one else has been able to accomplish. Fast forward with me back to Mark. Let's turn back to the book of Mark. Mark writes specifically to Roman Christians. To Roman Christians. Now, Romans, think about the Romans. Do they acknowledge the need for an authority, for a power figure, for a man of action in their life? They acknowledge Caesar as the head of their government. They acknowledge the centurions and the governors, generals in charge of their military. Perhaps some of these Romans are like us in that they understand there's a need for somebody to be on the throne, for there to be an authority. And so the answer that Mark is trying to give to these Roman Christians, he's trying to answer the question, why then should these Romans confess that Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ and that he should be Lord of their heart? Mark writes to them, as we've seen in chapters 1 and 2, tells them that Jesus is no ordinary man. He's a man of action. He's a man of power. He's a man of authority. Let's go back to Mark chapter 1. Notice this one aspect of Mark's gospel. It's the shortest of the four gospels that we have. And there's this word that shows up over and over again. And in fact, it shows up 9 times in the first chapter, 40 times in the entire book. That's not always talking about Jesus. It refers to the kind of things that happen when Jesus comes around. The word here is the word immediately. Verse 10, immediately coming up out of the water, Jesus saw the heavens open and the Spirit like a dove descending upon him. Verse 12, immediately the Spirit impelled him to go out into the wilderness. Verse 20, immediately he called them. They left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went to follow him. We'll go back up to verse 18. Immediately they left their nets and followed him. Verse 21, they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath day, he entered the synagogue and began to teach. Verse 28, immediately the news about him spread everywhere into all the surrounding district of Galilee. Are you catching on to what happens? When Jesus steps onto the scene, guess what? Stuff starts to happen. Things happen immediately when Christ shows up. Mark also organizes his book a little differently than the other Gospels. He basically starts Jesus in Galilee, and he says, Jesus starts in Galilee, and he goes straight to Jerusalem. It's not really in chronological order, because that's not Mark's intention, is to show every detail about the life of Jesus. Some of the other writers do a more full job of doing that. That's not Mark's emphasis. His emphasis is to show that Jesus is a man on the move. He's a man on the move. And he writes to move individuals to a confession that we read earlier. Mark chapter 8, verse 29. Eric read this for us. Jesus continued by questioning them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, saying to him, "You are the Christ." This is the hinge point right here of the book of Mark. Because it seems here like Mark focuses on the teachings, on the reaction, on the faith journey of Peter. It is widely believed that Mark was a young man and that he took the information from his gospel from the preaching of Peter, from what Peter taught and from what he witnessed. Where do we get Mark? Where does he come from? Does he show up anywhere else in the gospel? What qualifies him to write this gospel about Jesus, man of action and power and authority? Well, the first obvious mention we have of Mark is back in Acts chapter 12. Mark's mother, we think, was a fairly wealthy woman. She had a house, and the Christians would gather in her house. And specifically in Acts 12, they gather in her house because Peter's been thrown in prison. What happens when someone gets thrown in prison? Well, the church comes together, and they pray for the release of that man. Can you imagine being a young man and your mother houses many of the Christians? They come and they meet in your house, and people like Peter start to show up. People like Paul and Barnabas start to show up at your house. They stay down, you know, in the bedroom that's just down the hall to the right, two doors down. They stay in there. What an amazing experience for a young man. And yet we see Mark have perhaps similar struggles that young people have today. If you turn over to Acts chapter 13, Mark has been asked to go on a journey with Paul. And what happens? It doesn't take long before Mark deserts Paul and his companions. Now, we have young people out on the mission field. We have young people that we've sent out on the mission field. You think they're ever afraid? You think they ever have struggles? You think they ever have conflict between one another? You think they ever have a hard time when they're out there on the mission field? They certainly do. We see here that Mark perhaps is a normal young person. Doesn't have a death wish. He hasn't been brainwashed and just does things without thinking. I'm going to go here with Paul, but wait a minute, this is getting hard. I miss Mom. I miss Jerusalem. I miss going back home. And so he goes back home. He deserts the missionaries. Now, if you'll indulge me for a moment, Mark chapter 14, verse 51, Mark 14, 51. The scene in the garden prior to the crucifixion. A young man was following Jesus, wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body, and they seized him, but he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. Kind of an odd few verses to add. At this moment when Jesus is praying and his disciples desert, all of a sudden we get this account of this young man who was wearing nothing but a linen sheet, and he gets the sheet ripped off. And he's just left to run away naked. Poor guy. What a story to be told about you. Of all the great gospel things that are done, you were known as the man who ran away naked from the garden where Jesus was. Now, it's my belief, I'm not going to say that this is absolutely true, but Mark is the only one who includes this. It seems likely that this could be talking about Mark. That not only did he desert Paul and his companions on their missionary journeys, but Mark also deserted Jesus and the disciples in the garden. Regardless of our thoughts on Mark 14, we see that Mark writing this letter to the Romans, convincing them that Jesus is a man of power and of authority, that he's a fairly normal human being with fears and with desires and those kind of things. If you read more about Mark in the New Testament, 1 Peter 5:13 and Philemon verse 24 tell us that Mark was considered to be a son of Peter, perhaps because of the amount of time that he spent with the apostle. Paul eventually gets over the fact that that Mark deserted him, and he considers him to be a fellow worker. And so here we have this gospel of Mark from this young man who has so much experience in the church and with men in the church. And he understands there's a need to write down the teachings and the preaching of Peter. Let's go back to Mark chapter 8. I want to pay close attention to the verse that was read, because this is where Mark, he organizes his gospel in a way that this is where he wants those who read this, he wants them to get to this point right here. The first 8 chapters of Mark are almost exclusively dedicated to the works and the miracles and the actions of Jesus. And then all of a sudden in chapters 9 through 16, the emphasis changes from what Jesus does to the consequences of him being the Messiah. He becomes the Son of Man, the suffering servant. And so Mark spends 8 chapters convincing them, this is Jesus and this is why you need to listen to Jesus. And then he finishes the story and says, this is, now that you know who Jesus is, this is what he has to go and do. Verse 27 of Mark chapter 8. Jesus went out along with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he questioned his disciples, saying to them, who do people say I am? You think Jesus doesn't know? I really like it when he asks these questions, because I can see myself there as the apostles. Oh, Jesus asked a question. He doesn't know. I'm going to be the first one to answer him. Jesus knows the answer. But what do they say? Verse 28. They told him, saying, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, but others one of the prophets. Perhaps this was comforting to the Romans who were written to. To look here and say, you know, the Jews aren't even sure who Jesus is. We're off here in Rome and we're not sure who Jesus is. Most of the Jews weren't exactly sure who Jesus was. But Peter knows. And Peter knows because of the things that Mark talked about in the first 8 chapters. Because of the things he had seen. Beyond a doubt, Peter can say, you are the Christ. And then Jesus says, and he warned them to tell no one about him. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests, the scribes, and be killed. And after 3 days, he will rise again. What is Peter's confession based upon? Why should a Roman agree with a Jewish fisherman, Peter? Why should a Roman agree with this Jewish fisherman that a carpenter's son from nowhere Nazareth should be the one to rule their life? Mark challenges them. He challenges them to go back and to think about the reaction that everybody had about the coming of Jesus. Mark 2:12 says, all the people were glorifying God, saying, we have never seen anything like this. Not just a shock factor. Not just Jesus came and he shocked a bunch of people, because the Caesars shocked the world by what they did, by the evil that they participated in and the things that they did to people. It's not just a shock factor, but he wants them to think twice about a man who heals the sick, a man who touches lepers, who quiets the self-righteous, who reforms the cheater, who forgives the sinner, who suffers the insane, and who calls the purposeless. Perhaps this is the kind of man who can sit on the throne of my heart. I mean, what kind of God or king has this kind of authority in all situations? What kind of God or king has power over this much adversity? What kind of God, what kind of king has the mission to humble the arrogant and to glorify the humble? What kind of man, what kind of God, what kind of king can do such marvelous things day after day after day after day? Peter and the Romans and us today should expect no less from a God that came in the flesh. This man is Jesus. This is God in the flesh. And he is like nothing that you have ever seen before. But you know what? He is exactly what we all need. We may have never seen anyone like Jesus, but he is exactly what each of us needs. Do you know Jesus today? Because if you don't know Jesus, Mark says he is worth investigating. He loves you more than you know, and he is able to sit on the throne of your heart. Do you know Jesus? Maybe you do. If you do, then tell his story. Tell his story. Because if people don't know who Jesus is, how can they call on his name? How can they believe in him? How can they hear if no one preaches to them? Perhaps maybe you know Jesus, but you've forgotten that he ought to have the authority and the power in your life. So we invite you now, as we offer the invitation, come to know Jesus better. Reacquaint yourself with Jesus, because he's like nothing you've ever seen, but he is exactly what you need. If we can help in any way, if we can offer prayers for you, as Scott mentioned earlier, if we can extend and help you to become close to Christ in baptism, to become clothed in him, then please come forward while we stand and sing together.